Welcome to Corporate Wayfinding, Conversations in Transformation with Dr. J.P. Gedeon.
Hi everyone, it's J.P. Gedeon. Welcome to another episode of Corporate Wayfinding. I'm really glad you're able to join us. Today we are in for a special treat because we are going to talk to Mr. Jeff Fielding. Now if you don't know a lot about Jeff, he started his career in the municipal sector here in Ontario many decades ago, and since has held some senior management positions right across the country. He was a chief administrative officer in his hometown of Kitchener, and then later in Burlington, then London, and then had a long and very successful stint as the city manager in Calgary. Most recently, he's been the chief of staff at the City of Toronto before his very recent retirement. Now, not only is Jeff a public administrator, but he's also an educator. He lectured at Western University's Ivy School of Business in the MBA and Executive MBA programs, predominantly on change and leadership. He also was part of the lecturing team at the University of Winnipeg, as well as a lecturer at the University of Manitoba in the Master of City Planning program. Jeff is a visionary leader and known to be so in the government sector. His dedication have made him sought after as an advisor. He's also an illustrious award recipient. He's a board member of several large-scale organizations across the country and also an executive in residence at the Institute for Leadership at the Ivy School of Business. Jeff was the first recipient of the Award of Excellence in Local Government from Western University, and he's received a John Robinson Award for Reducing Violence Against Women and a Calgary Construction Association Partnership Award for Industry Partnership. Now, we've done this podcast because of COVID over a Zoom call, so bear with us a little bit if the sound is a little bit tinny. Enjoy the conversation. Hey, Jeff, welcome. Thanks for joining us today. It's a pleasure having you here, especially to talk about local government and COVID-19. You and I go back a long ways, and it's great to see your face again.
Oh, thanks so much. It's great to join you.
So I thought maybe we could start with sort of a very general question that might open the door to a lot of discussion, which is that once this crisis hit, we've heard a lot about government's involvement in it, usually feds and the province, to some degree municipalities. We hear a lot about public health being used and being mobilized. We hear a lot about emergency being called, and we hear a lot about long-term care concerns. But I think at the municipal and local level, there's a whole truckload of stuff that ends up getting mobilized we don't normally hear about. So I thought maybe I'd start there and give you a chance to tell us all about that, and then we can talk about it.
Yeah, this is really unusual. We've not seen anything like this in the past. So this is brand new for us all. We've dealt with emergency situations. You know, we've activated the emergency operations centers across the country on different occasions, some for public health reasons, other times for winter storms, ice storms, flooding. Those types of things are, you know, they happen regularly. And so you're somewhat practiced at how you would respond to those emergency situations. But this was almost making it up on the fly. We had to really consider what the implications were going to be in terms of the community. But likewise, it has a huge impact on the workforce in the cities that across the country and around the world. And, you know, it impacts the way in which revenues are generated for municipalities. And it obviously has cost incredible amounts of expense relative to being able to respond appropriately to the virus.
So making things up on the fly is pretty tough. How do you find that, generally speaking, municipal executive teams have responded to this?
Well, I think this is what's so unusual. Like I say, I mean, we activated in Toronto the EOC immediately, and that's a practiced operation. People understand how to work in a command and control situation. Everybody understood what stations to be at and what their roles would be. But beyond that, when you started to move into the recovery phase, how are you going to turn back the economy? How are you going to bring back workers to the workplace? Those are the things that, you know, take a lot of preparation, consideration, and also you're dealing with services directly to the public. So how are you going to interface in a new way with the public in a way in which you haven't done in the past? And so these are things that are under consideration right now. And you have to merge your recovery strategy with your public health strategy. If they don't come together in some way, you're either going to drop the ball on the public health issues that are driving the response to the virus, or you're not going to get back to recovery as quickly as you'd like to. So these are not practiced. These are day-to-day situations, and it's hard to get yourself, you know, 3 months, 6 months down the road because you've not been there before. There's nothing to relate to.
So to clarify, though, the public health strategy is usually led by the province, and you got to work in a fabric with the province and the municipalities. Is that right?
And this is, again, an unusual situation, and, you know, it's not the same across the country. Mm-hmm. You know, in Toronto, for example, there is a medical officer of health, and she has a great deal of control in terms of what the response will be to the virus and how we're going to deal with those unique circumstances within the community. Likewise, in the regions across Ontario, those medical officers of health are deciding how best to proceed. And there is a provincial medical officer of health as well. So those strategies have to dovetail from the province to the regions to the cities.
And how does information flow in that system?
Well, I think that's, again, not practiced. So right. You know, these are unusual set of circumstances. There's a lot of conversation taking place between those medical officers of health. But when you get down into the business aspects of municipalities and the relationship between what's happening at the federal level, what should be happening at the provincial level, and how is that going to impact what's happening at the on the ground within the municipality, those are challenging relationships that haven't been practiced and aren't necessarily easily put in place.
So is there talk about putting protocols in place now that we now see we need that we never thought of before?
You know, everybody's saying don't waste this crisis. I think this is an opportunity to rethink government and to rethink some of those relationships. You know, what is the relationship of a city the size of Toronto in terms of the national economy, the importance it placed on the federal scene? How important is Toronto in terms of the province and the GTA communities? How do they, you know, interact with a larger economy within the province and within the country? But when you're sitting with if I use across the country, the six major cities in Canada generate 30% of the economy. So when you're looking at those types of numbers and saying those cities are going to need significant reinforcement coming out of this virus, and as we turn back the economy to generate the economic activity in those cities, they can't be left to their own. They're going to need some assistance both from the federal and provincial government. So I suspect there are going to be some regulatory and policy changes that are going to be necessary. There's going to have to be some unique circumstances in terms of thinking outside the box and rethinking and rebuilding the way government operates and one to another and on the ground in the municipalities.
So pardon my ignorance on this one, but I've heard a lot about programs from the feds that are going directly to citizens or to small businesses, but I've not heard a lot about realigning funding conventions among different levels of government. Is that being discussed actually, or is it just something that we see needs to happen?
Well, the Federation of Canadian Municipalities have put in a fairly significant ask about 6 weeks ago, I think was about right. The timeline. And, you know, that really was in the billions of dollars. And that was to assist municipalities to recover some of the costs that have already been spent up front. But there's no new additional ask, I guess is the best way to put it, that's come forward in the last 4 to 5 weeks. So as the costs continue to rise and as the economies in those local municipalities are affected, and so the revenues that are supporting the tax base are being eroded, those circumstances right now are not being dealt with. So I think there's hope from both the province and the municipalities that there will be assistance at the federal level to assist those municipalities to get back on their feet. And there also has to be some consideration from the provincial level about how they can assist the economies in those cities. But the real difficulty right now is that there's not a lot of money kicking around.
Right.
I mean, the federal government is talking about billions of dollars in terms of the cost of this response, north of $200 billion, I hear, most recently. And that those numbers are large also in terms of the provinces. So, you know, it's not going to be an easy get out of the jail, so to speak, in terms of how you're going to be able to move forward.
Yeah, and municipalities, their income tends to be property tax and some miscellaneous user fees and development fees, mostly. Isn't that correct? So if that drops, then there's really hot water because there's no other alternatives presently.
Well, and there's been forgiveness in terms of collecting property taxes. You know, there's hope that those property taxes will be collected. So there's been deferrals. But that has an impact on the bottom line in the municipalities. There will be businesses that go out of business. It can't be helped. I mean, certainly when you're looking at restaurants not being able to serve any customers for, weeks on end, when you're looking at, the other retail operations not being able to open their doors, mm-hmm. to have shoppers come in the front door to buy the goods and services that are available. So there's a variety of different things that are going to happen. That will be the consequences of this virus that have longer term impact.
Do you have a sense of, or is there any report that is suggesting what proportion of small businesses might really end up closing? The reason I'm asking is a good friend of mine has a child who lives downtown, and we were on the phone yesterday, and he said that he was alarmed by the number of for lease signs he's seeing in storefronts as he's walking along main roads.
I think that that's going to be a real serious consideration when you consider that, a large portion of our property tax base in municipalities comes from the commercial, non-residential side of the equation.
Yes.
Disrupting the supply chain and disrupting those businesses the way they've been disrupted, it's going to have an impact. And, certainly next year, going into 2021, looking at how you're going to raise taxes, if that's going to be acceptable, at this point in time when people are already back on their heels, mm-hmm. I think most politicians would not be looking favorably on increasing taxes too dramatically. So the costs are significant and they will have a lot lasting impact going into 2021 and maybe even beyond.
What kind of a debt load is a municipality allowed to carry?
Well, you really can't carry a deficit.
So right, that's what I thought. Yeah.
So coming out of this year, municipalities aren't allowed to have a deficit.
Right.
I don't think municipalities even want the legislation changed to allow for that. I think that they want to balance their bottom line. But that said, I mean, we're going to be in a situation where, coming out of this, do we have the capital, for example, to partner on infrastructure programs? You'll recall that this is in the past, we've always used infrastructure as a way of rebooting the economy. Mm-hmm. And investing in roads and bridges and pipes and those types of things. Well, will the municipalities have that capacity to be able to be in a partnership with the other levels of government? We'll have to wait and see. Where's the private sector on these, investments? Certainly there are parts of the economy that have actually fared fairly well during this period of time. So we'll have to wait and see just exactly how, how business comes back. And how those partnerships are going to be, certainly they're going to have to be different than they've done in the past.
Well, I got to tell you, I wish I'd bought out stock in any online meeting program sometime in January.
Well, digital, there is no doubt that we found out how important digital will be in the future.
Correct.
In this downturn and in the response to the virus, because large portions of cities just didn't have access to the internet for children, in neighborhoods where, the cost of internet is expensive. Mm-hmm. And if you couldn't afford that, to have that at home, and you wouldn't have access to school programs, for example, if you had to, stay at home to take care of your children and then provide some education opportunities in the home. So these are all things that are sorting themselves out.
So, that's an interesting point, this whole notion of the digitization of community and society because of where we're heading. And the prohibitive costing for some sectors for that. Who's supposed to take up the mantle of that? And is that starting to become a priority at any level of government. So maybe that, and maybe the part two of the question is, so how is government starting to change how it thinks about itself and its role for tomorrow?
Well, I think that, first of all, the two-parter on that. The first one is that the infrastructure needs to be built in cities. And, you know, to a large extent, the major carriers in Canada have a significant role to play in extending 5G and other types of digital infrastructure. They're going to rely on municipalities to do the approvals and to create the, you know, the space in the rights of way so that they can actually install that infrastructure. You know, there's going to have to be some partnership with those municipalities, and what that partnership is going to look like, I think that's up for debate and up for discussion. That could be something completely new in terms of how those relationships will work out and what revenues opportunities there are for municipalities. So from the perspective of saying there's great interest in digital, there's great interest in terms of installing that infrastructure that's going to allow for 5G and other types of digital infrastructure. Now the thing is really to think about, if it's in place, how do you reinvent yourself such that you can use that infrastructure to provide frontline service, you know, to our citizens. And that's going to take some time to, you know, to think out. It's not going to happen overnight, but this is the point about, you know, really focusing on rebuilding in the future around ways in which services can be provided. So that's the challenge. Can municipalities execute around an agenda focused in on digital, focused in on a new way of doing business?
Well, yeah, and not to ask a question that in its base is actually extreme, and I realize it is, but there are some advocacy groups that are trying to get sort of digital connectivity on the same list as, you know, water and electricity as a necessity of life. I'm going to presume that there's going to be some significant political pressure and activism going on around this. How does that play into this whole thing?
I agree with you there. I think all levels of government are interested in a digital strategy for Canada. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that, you know, the challenge that we have is that the major carriers, you know, have their own customer load. They want their own infrastructure, but that doesn't allow for seamless, you know, coordination across a municipality. So, you know, if you're a customer that, for example, in Toronto and the subway line, there's a, you know, I won't mention the carrier, but that carrier has their customers. That service is not being provided for want of a variety of different reasons. No blame on anybody. But the fact is, if you're not a customer of that carrier, you won't have access to, you know, making a phone call while on the subway.
Right.
So, you know, you don't want to have a system in place across your municipality that has access issues. You want to make sure it's seamless for everybody.
Yeah, and I guess the question really goes back to that debate discussion you were talking about earlier. Traditionally speaking, we would think of a municipality's functions, you know, their core functions around service delivery and infrastructure building. But then the question becomes, could digitization of the community become one of the core functions? Would the government consider one day being a primary driver of this?
I think that's a big consideration. I mean, mm-hmm. there are municipalities that have black fiber already in place, and, you know, it certainly is not extended across the entire city. But there are, you know, opportunities here for partnership. It'll be interesting to see if the CRTC sees it differently and, you know, enables those partnerships to take place, as opposed to allowing for individual carriers to, you know, develop their own systems within the cities and have access to light standards and, you know, those types of locations that they're going to need to extend their infrastructure. So that's going to be an interesting debate, and it'll be interesting to see whether or not those partnerships will evolve and if there's a revenue stream associated with it for continuous investment for municipalities.
Right. You know, this is just such a crazy time of transformation. Even everything you're talking about, we're even talking about potentially reworking how governments work, right? It's just a massive realignment. And like you said, never waste a good crisis, right? And here we are in one. So in terms of transformation, and I don't mean this specifically for Toronto, because you know that's where you were up until very, very recently, until your retirement. But in general, in government in general, or perhaps in industry, or perhaps in both, Do you have any sense now that we're in the middle of a crisis, what leaders need to exhibit or have or be in order to look into the future effectively and be open to these kinds of wild reworkings of a system?
Well, you know what's going to be fascinating is that we are at the start of the largest generational shift in public service that we've ever seen.
Yes.
And as a generation is now moving through, it's at the end of its, I'll call it, lifespan within public service. Many of us have worked in public service for a very long period of time. And so there's going to be a vacuum there that of leadership that was in place for a very long period. And not to say that they actually, you know, people like myself, my generation, didn't necessarily have a strong view of what service delivery could look like and how it could be different. Mm-hmm. And so potentially the next generation coming up will be charged with, you know, rethinking government as the, you know, my generation exits public service and the next generation takes over. And so, you know, that challenge is really to envision what public service can be, how it can be different, and how you rebuild using this, you know, crisis as the means to drive that change.
Do you think that that's an internal government conversation among intergovernment levels, or is that a democratic consideration that goes to elections?
Yeah, I think you've hit the nail on the head. I think there are some things that are going to have to be with the electorate. I think people are going to have to decide, you know, whether or not private sector can provide the services that people need, and public sector needs to get out of the way,
right,
and allow for private sector to invest and to build, you know, a new way of delivering service. But if there's reluctance to move those types of services to the private sector, and we've seen with long-term care, a repatriation of some of those long-term care facilities that might not be performing to the level that people would expect, and governments taking them back. So there is going to be a lot of tension in that, you know, rebuilding and re-envisioning what government could look like at all levels.
Yeah, that's what's fascinating. The unraveling of the old legacy system that's been around forever and the reweaving of what this new system could look like by a generation that up until now really hasn't had executive authority, dealing with an electorate that, while being hamstrung financially, is trying to figure out how to best position itself for future readiness so it can get out of the slump and not end up in it again.
That's it. And the other thing that has to come, you know, together with this is the educational opportunities for leaders to learn and to understand how they can affect change and influence delivery of services in the future. So there has to be those development opportunities through universities and colleges, mm-hmm, to, you know, to advance the abilities of people that are coming up in the next generation, that, you know, to give them the tools and to give them the foresight to be able to lead into the next, you know, into the next decade.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because you know all my work is in corporate transformation, both public and private sector, so constantly working in the transformation field. And one of the things that we run across a lot is how one of the most powerful things that a leader brings into change exercises is their character. And I think that this crisis, you know, whereas in the past there was a lot of conversation around processes and ways of doing it and change management frameworks, etc., but a lot of the cutting edge science, especially in leadership psychology, really emphasizes that the leader's character and his or her capacity to broker certain types of relationships is critical in a transformative space. So I'm wondering, if you agree with me, what your thoughts are about, you know, the readiness in government in general, and in terms of having whatever that transformative character would look like in the up-and-coming leaders, or if that's a place where universities can really start helping and professional development and mentoring and such.
Well, traditionally, you know, if there's been a soft spot in budgets, it's always been on leadership development.
Yeah, first thing that gets cut, right?
Right, personal growth. So it troubles me that, you know, as we go into some concerns about budgets in the next few years, whether those dollars are going to be available, because they're absolutely necessary, as you've indicated. They're going to have to develop the skills in the next generation of public leaders, public service leaders, to be able to do the type of work that's necessary. When you talk about character, I think that, you know, the one thing that's absolutely critical in public service is that, you know, you get a lot of satisfaction out of making other people's life successful.
Right.
You know, that it's not about yourself. It's about enabling others to be successful. And so, you know, creating an atmosphere of meaningful work that contributes to people's lives, that makes a difference in their quality of lives, and that will effectively allow for, you know, changes in municipalities that, whether it's a diverse population, how you're going to be inclusive in terms of hiring, your hiring practices, mm-hmm. how you're going to delegate authority down to the lower ranks so that you can, you know, be nimble and agile. You know, you're going to have to develop leaders that have that capacity to, you know, to inspire their employees and their workforce, and make sure that those people feel that they're making a difference every day that they come to work. And so the leadership is going to change substantially in terms of how it goes, much more away from regulatory and operational discussions, much more to enabling and basically delegating to people so that they can carry out their tasks without the bureaucracy that's in place.
Yeah, you know, a colleague of mine does a lot of work with leadership assessments and competence modeling and all that kind of stuff all over industry. And we were just talking yesterday, and, you know, he's agreed to do another one of these episodes also just on his findings. He's finding that leadership competence models around industry are actually changing in the past 2 to 3 months. And what he's finding is things that used to be the top of the competence model, like visioning and strategic thought, et cetera, are now being considered just table stakes. And they're not even being named on new competence models. But things like agility, creativity, innovation, resilience have recently shot up to the top of the list of competence models. They've shifted their models. Yep. So and it might be unfair to get you to speak for all of government, but, you know, just on an opinion basis, how ready or set up do you think current government is to be as agile, creative, innovative, and resilient as they need to be, considering the size of the challenge ahead?
Well, I think that we haven't had a history that shows that.
Right.
I think that, you know, we're pretty much a steady state organization in municipal government.
Yeah.
And, you know, can't speak much for provincial and federal government, but at the municipal level, you know, we've been pretty consistent in terms of the way we provide service over a long period of time. Things haven't changed that much. And I think that, you know, having the people in place that actually see things differently and will take the opportunities that come their way and be skillful in terms of how we go about doing that. You know, the biggest challenge that those leaders are going to have to do and work through is just trust. You know, it's going to be confidence and trust in terms of the public that you serve and in terms of your workforce. And if you can't establish that confidence and trust, you're not going to be able to move forward on these new initiatives that are going to be vital to, you know, the future of municipal government.
Yeah, you're talking trust within the corporation and also between the corporation and the community it serves.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the one thing that you don't get the advantage of in public service that, you know, does cause people to, you know, stand back from, you know, taking those chances and taking the risks is that, you know, the criticism is about reading yourself in social media, you know, seeing your picture on the front pages of a newspaper for something that went wrong. And, you know, a mistake at the public sector level sets everybody back. Mm-hmm. And then at that point, you know, you don't want to put your head above the top of the fence. If you don't have risk takers in an organization, you're not going to get the innovation. And if you can't make mistakes, innovation and creativity won't follow.
Well, that's really interesting because public sector organizations, and I mean, I've worked in the public sector across the country. I mean, you and I have worked together in a couple of instances. So, you know, everywhere I go, public sector organizations are characterized by risk aversion because conservatism seems safer and more responsible with a public purse. And yet everything I'm hearing in this conversation is that the new world requires a degree of entrepreneurial risk-taking and sticking your head up over the fence, that would literally mean that we are completely redesigning municipal culture.
I agree. And, you know, this is going to take some work on behalf of leadership, that they're comfortable in their own skin, that, you know, if the jobs that they're doing today are not necessarily the jobs for the future, that they'll take on the responsibility to get trained and do the development, individual development, professional development that they need, that you're going to have new relationships with the unions in terms of being able to, you know, refocus the workforce, redeploy that workforce, the work that needs to be done. I mean, right now across the country, people are being redeployed to assist in the response to COVID. So if we can do it in terms of a response model to COVID, you should be able to do that when it returns back to normal and you need different workers doing different types of work.
So here's another tough question. In light of the fact that we got to shift governmental culture and that there was such risk aversion because, you know, social media and media, if you got caught, that was a big deal. I guess the tricky question is, what's media's role then in this transformation to help facilitate the new world?
I have probably a different perspective on the media than most of my colleagues.
Okay.
I welcome their inspection. Mm-hmm. You know, I welcome their opportunity to challenge the conventional wisdom of the municipality and administrators, and to be critical. At the same time, you know, to build a relationship there so that you can move things ahead and be able to communicate the advantages of change to a large population. You know, over time, we just do not have the reach, neither through social media or through the regular media, at the municipal level. And people are not necessarily paying attention to what happens, you know, in their council meetings or happening within the administration. And so what you see over time is that lack of risk, but you also see at the other side is sometimes you get bad behavior when you're not being watched. Mm-hmm. So there's an advantage to have that, you know, critical insight that only the media can bring. But it's also necessary for them to communicate in a broader sense about how we need to work in the future. And if you see the way, you know, the media is being very responsible in terms of COVID right now.
Yes.
I mean, they're making the data available. They're talking about what the public needs to know, how the public can stay safe. So they're being very responsible in terms of directing and leading the communications across the country that are making a difference in people's lives.
Yeah, I've noticed that. And they're being more forgiving of politicians in that they're not leaping onto potential gaffes that may have happened. Or, you know, how in the past they would riff on a word that was used and they didn't like and it turns into a whole thing. I'm not seeing a lot of that. I'm just wondering, once the crisis passes, if they will, I don't want to say work together with, because that doesn't make sense. The scrutiny and observation you're talking about will keep government honest. But at the same time, if media gets overly stringent on their job, it might promote risk aversion again, which will slow down the entire process and the whole block just stops moving.
That's the risk. I mean, there's no doubt about that. But by the same token, I think you need courageous leaders in public service, mm-hmm, that are prepared to take that on and defend their decisions. And so, you know, that's what, you know,
and you're talking both politically and at the staff level.
Absolutely. So when you're looking at it from the perspective of saying you need creativity, you need innovation, you also need courage. And so you're going to, in terms of character, that's something that either you have or you don't. Either you're prepared to stand on your own conviction and you're making good quality decisions and what you're deciding is going to have a difference in the way in which that service will be delivered, and that people eventually will understand why it needs to change. Leaders are going to have to stand on their own two feet in the next, you know, numbers of years to affect the change that's necessary.
You know, it's interesting. You're talking about recruiting and bringing people on. And, I work as part of the transformation work I do, often I end up with an HR touch point where we're looking at recruitment and succession planning and performance approaches and all that kind of stuff to help with the transformation. And what I've noticed a lot in the public sector is that job descriptions are incredibly task-focused, the way they're written. And what I'm hearing you kind of imply, although you haven't said it directly, so I don't mean to put words in your mouth, correct me if I am, I've often said to my HR clients when I'm consulting with them, imagine a world where the job description pointed out sort of the minimum knowledge or certification you needed for this job. So if I need a nurse, you need to be a nurse. Okay, gotcha. But the rest of the job description is not talking about this task, that task, the other task, the third task, but rather is talking about courage, character, self-efficacy, optimism, hope, you know, that kind, that's what we're looking for. That is a significant transformative shift in terms of how we would look for people. What do you think about the capacity and readiness to start thinking like that?
Well, that is, you know, I'll be honest, that's a challenge. I mean, you hit the nail on the head. We boxed or compartmentalized jobs for years and years and years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the pay grades are dependent upon those compartmental, qualifications for each of the jobs.
That's right.
And when I'm frequently in front of MBA students, and when I ask them, you know, to put their hand up and say how many of them are going to join public service, very few hands go up.
Three, right? Between three and five.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's not a profession that younger people necessarily gravitate towards. And so I think that, you know, we need to be able to create an environment in public service that's attractive. And I will tell you, there's nothing better in terms of the challenges and opportunities you have in public service. Every day there's something different that happens that you can make a difference. Mm-hmm. Now, when you think that there's 500, you know, in the city of Toronto, over 500 services being provided by the municipality, over 35,000 employees. Think of the scope and scale of the opportunity to work in an environment like that, where you could affect change into the future. We've just got to create, you know, the circumstances to recruit the right people, to bring them into the organization and cut them loose. Even the work environment itself, you know, when you take a look at the top quality employers in terms of the spaces that they create for young people and the access to technology that they have, that's not necessarily the same at a public service organization or a municipality. So, you know, you're starting with, you know, on your heels already trying to recruit those people into an environment that they don't see themselves fitting into.
Yeah. And you kind of brought up something for me, which I'm interested in hearing your perspective. Historically, many governments, municipalities probably more so than other levels, but not necessarily, have endured what I like to call organizational traumas, you know, where there's been amalgamations or really bad leadership or downloading or upload, whatever it is. And sometimes those traumas affect culture pretty deeply and hang out for a long time. And sometimes they're never healed. So I guess my question is COVID enough of a crisis that it is dissolving those traumas to move us past them? Or do you think we still have to overcome history while trying to transform?
Yeah, that's, you know, I don't have an answer for that. I mean, I'll use the city example of, you know, the amalgamation and how long ago that happened, and still a legacy in place within the organization that points back to that traumatic experience of, you know, of jamming all those municipalities together into a new government. And so, you know, they're still dealing with the aftermath of amalgamation. So here we have a set of circumstances that, you know, upsets the apple cart. It's certainly disruptive. Do we have the capacity, capability, the know-how to be able to use it as a springboard into some different future? That's the unknown. I'm not certain that we have that capacity.
But the risk is, if we don't, the whole thing can crumble under our feet.
Well, simply put, people won't be able to afford local government.
Right.
You know, and so I think it's going to be a situation that, you know, this has created an economic circumstances and a financial circumstances for municipalities. When I talk to my colleagues across the country, most of the big city managers already were saying before we hit COVID that, you know, they were on their knees in terms of their financial situations, responding to social pressures, responding to downturns in the economy. You go across the country and you see those big cities that are, you know, really dealing with some challenging circumstances on their financial bottom line. And so now coming out of COVID, that stability, or that sustainability, I should say, is really, really a challenging aspect of the future. So those are the things that are going to come to the fore. You're not going to be able to tax your way out of this situation. You're going to have to come to the table with something different. And those municipalities, just like in business, that are able to, you know, harness the energy within the organization, the expertise within their communities, to be able to come up with something different, they're the ones that are going to lead into the future. You know, we spend a large portion of our capital budget, for example, on maintaining existing infrastructure. You know, infrastructure that's, you know, 60, 70, 80 years old. Yeah. We're not building the infrastructure for the future like some of the other cities in the world. And so, you know, we're in competition with other cities across this, across the entire world.
Right.
And if you can't compete with what's going on in places like China or Asia, in
Singapore,
Singapore, yeah. You know, you can point to those, Norway, Sweden,
yeah.
You know, where the investment's being made in the future, as opposed to just looking over your shoulder and repairing what you've had in the past. That really is going to have to come hand in hand with the COVID recovery.
Yeah, it makes me wonder, like I hadn't thought of this until I'm listening to you talk. It makes me wonder, in the absence of an adaptive, transformative municipal response, when we add on the capacity to telework and the price that might be tacked on to living in large urban centers, it makes me start to wonder if the population will move out to more rural centers where rent is lower, I can work from home. Is it possible that we could see a societal shift like that?
Again, it's a really interesting question to say what will be the impact of having to go to downtown Toronto, as an example, to go to work, as opposed to staying at home in your, I live in Burlington, used to travel to downtown Toronto. I mean, would the future be that I would be able to work, 80% of the time at home? Would that have an impact on office space? Is that going to have a substantial impact in terms of productivity? Are we going to trust our employees that they're going to be able to do the work that's necessary when they're not under the guise of a manager? You know, these are all questions that we're going to see coming forward. But you know worldwide, that's the way people are working. And so increasingly, at a municipal level, we're going to be challenged to be able to do that in a meaningful way and stay productive.
Yeah, and I'm currently working with a number of clients, big automotive as well as big government, around leadership approaches that are engineered to help increase engagement and involvement and psychological ownership within the workforce that now are not sitting in the same space and that don't see each other very much. You know, the old notion of visibility as professional currency, you know, like the more I see you, the more top of mind you are, is now gone. It's almost like people have to prove their value in a different way. And so we're talking about that and also talking about the capacity to be innovative and efficient, whereas in the old world, so much brainstorming happened in the hallway as I was going to get my coffee and I ran into you and we just exchanged some thought. This world is much more deliberative about that kind of a thing. So that's a considerable shift in what we're leading.
You know what? You mentioned something about the psychology of people. And I think that that's going to be a challenge in the next few years as well, in the sense that all the literature tells us that you need psychological safety in the workplace for people to feel that they can do their best.
Right.
And, you know, are we going to have layoffs hanging over people's heads? Are we going to be able to recover the economy? Will it come back the way it was? Will people that, you know, in jobs, professional positions, where you had two wage earners making a substantial amount of income between the two of them, now impacted, you know, with large mortgages? You know, traditionally, those less fortunate have been our focus. But this is telling us now that there's a lot of people right now that are gainfully unemployed that may not get back into the positions that they held in the past.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And so this may be the, you know, a trigger for a lot of business to downsize, to right size, to reshape, rethink. And if that's happening in the private sector, the same thing I think would hold true that you could expect that to happen in municipal government, that the number of jobs may not be the same number pre-COVID as it will be post-COVID.
So there is a possibility of a significant unemployment spike out of this.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how quickly it does come back. I mean, currently, there's a lot of people working at home. That will they go back to work? There's a lot of people right now that are being supported by the social the social network that's in place to help us through this real rough patch. Mm-hmm. So we'll have to see.
It's the number I'm hearing from some of my clients, not bigger clients, smaller clients, actually, is 30%, that they have managed to find efficiencies and rework their processes that they think 30% of the people that used to work for them are not going to be coming back. I found that an alarming number. Now, larger corporations and municipalities would not be exempt from this, have a different set of conventions because they're dealing with unions. So that's going to figure into this a lot. Has there been a considerable shift in union relations as a result of this?
Well, the union relationship has been, pretty solid through this, especially at the municipal level, because I think most people realize the unique circumstances we find ourselves in.
Yeah.
That we're all in it together, as the saying goes. And I think that from the perspective of realizing that, people will have to be redeployed to the areas of work that are necessary to respond to COVID. But will they be so willing in the future as we come out of this into a recovery phase and start in on the rebuilding and reimagining phase where their jobs are at risk? And so I think a very interesting conversation is going to happen across the country.
Yeah. Just also the other aspect to this that I've been thinking a lot about is, if this notion of working from home and teleworking becomes more of a norm, and I can't imagine that it won't, because after 6 months of having your people work at home, how do you tell them you have to go back to work? That they're not allowed to work from home anymore. So I think that it's going to become a significant reality. I started wondering about what becomes the status of an employee in this new world. It used to be that you belong to the corporation and they belong to you. But when I work from home, I get a sense that more people feel like they are entrepreneurially lending their talents to this corporation at this time, which really changes the landscape of career management.
Yeah, it's peculiar. I talk from a personal perspective that I have found it somewhat isolating.
Yeah.
It's a situation for me that, not going to work, not having the ability to interact with people face to face, not having that the opportunity to sit in a boardroom and whiteboard your thoughts and strategize, having to do that in a different way, using the tools that we're now using to be able to hold those types of meetings, holding people's attention for that length of time.
So hard.
It is. And so it'll be interesting to see just how that evolves in the future.
Yeah, I don't really know. But I do think that it'll have a psychological effect on how we think about our place in a corporation as time goes on.
I agree. I found it a challenge for myself. I can't imagine that I'm alone in that.
And from a leadership perspective, this is the part that, as a guy who works in psychology of leadership, that means that the old world of command and control is literally going to slowly fade into history because of the very physical and technological ways that we might end up working. The capacity to influence and mentor and internally motivate, I think, becomes some of the top management capacities, which goes right back to character again.
I agree. Inspiration is so important in the workplace.
Yeah.
When you feel inspired, leadership is important in that. In generating that inspiration. If you don't have that and you don't see it on a regular basis, I don't know what that looks like. So there's a lot of unanswered questions. We'll see what the next, because people are going to test this more and more fully in the next year for sure. They're going to see whether or not that they can basically take advantage of what they've learned to this point and double down on some of these savings or some of these opportunities to see whether or not they can work in this new way. So it's a wait and see set of circumstances for sure.
So let me ask you sort of like a last kind of wrap up question that is more theoretical and daydreamy, I suppose. What do you hope the future could look like and how can people get ready?
Well, I think first of all, I think that what we'll see is more and more people focused in on the types of services and the roles and responsibilities at different levels. Who does what? It's going to be a critical conversation. And so I think it's really important that governments get together, eliminate the duplication, get rid of the bureaucracy, streamline the processes, make sure that the private sector and individuals making investments in their communities, that they're realized, that we move from a regulatory environment to a more enabling environment to make people successful. So I hope that there's an attitudinal shift out of this that says, you know, we're here for you, we got to make it work, and we're prepared to do whatever it takes to bring about your own individual or your collective success.
Yeah. And do you have any hints or advice for how people can best position themselves to be ready for this?
Well, again, it comes back to saying, you know, if you don't get a lot of satisfaction out of helping others, you're in the wrong profession. If you're in the
I guess so. Yeah. Jeff, thank you so much for your time. Your insights are always so edifying to me. I learn so much when I talk to you. And maybe we can have you on a second time, or maybe if I can get somebody else from other municipalities, you'll help me co-host a little bit.
That'd be great. I'd love to do that.
That was the incredible Jeff Fielding. Join me in the next episode where we talk to David Patterson, Vice President of GM Canada. David and I are going to talk about GM's positioning now in the COVID crisis and how they are planning to evolve and turn the corner, especially with GM's incredible environmental initiatives, as well as their current involvement in helping Canadians deal with the COVID crisis. A fascinating conversation, and I look forward to talking to you then. In the meantime, I'm JP Gideon. Take care.
Join us next time for Corporate Wayfinding, Conversations in Transformation, with Dr. JP Gideon.